Yisro, as you know, Yisro is a hugely packed parsha. Essentially, contains Kol Torah Kula, at least in the summary form. So certainly, one could speak about Yisro forever. This is again an advantage of our focus on one aliyah at a time. The fourth aliyah of Yisro is relatively short; it's very short, it's just a 6 psukim. But even though it's not the one that perhaps gets the most attention, it is extremely significant, and there are certainly a few phrases here that become very crucial, very, very crucial to our national identity. So this is also something we can appreciate in our plan, the ability within all of the literal thunder and lightning and noise and drama of Parshas Yisro to be able to focus on the 6 psukim in the fourth aliyah is a special privilege for us. So let's try to see what we could do with these psukim. So we begin, Bachodesh HaShlishi, Vatseis Bnei Yisrael, Me'eretz Mitzrayim, B'yom HaZeh, Bo Midbar Sinai. So Bachodesh HaShlishi, so that's already noteworthy, the fact that here we are approaching Matan Torah, and it is 3 months now since leaving Mitzrayim. So that's worth asking about, why is it that it takes 3 months? So here the Arachayim comments that there has to be somewhat of a separation between the experience in Mitzrayim and Kabbalah Satorah. We have to be able to shake off that influence. And by Simon in the Sefer Mebarach, he quotes a Sefer that says a little bit more synergistically for us, learning Gittin. So we talked earlier in the year about the notion of Havchana, about the fact that there is a requirement, Chazal have as a little plug, that if a woman gets divorced, she's not allowed to remarry for at least 3 months. And those 3 months we call Chodshei Havchana, that there has to be a clear separation in case there's a child, so we have to know, did the child come from the previous husband or the second husband? So here the imagery is also relevant, that it's necessary to really clear the slate here and to make it absolutely distinct where the Torah comes from, and that the influence of Mitzrayim has to be completely separated out. And this is something we can relate to, that especially with all of the influences that come at us from so many different directions, it can be very hard to know what is what and what comes from where, and to be able to separate out the different influences and sometimes the confusion that comes from all of our complicated context. So to appreciate that when the Torah was given, so there's this need for Chodshei Havchana, so to speak, that it can't be the day after we leave Mitzrayim. We can't have a context where perhaps there could be some mixture, and perhaps we may not be totally clear as to what comes from where. So therefore, to have this 3-month separation from the time we leave Mitzrayim and the receiving of the Torah, so that's understood. So here, even though it's not the full 3 months, but the idea of the beginning of the 3 months. So here, the Aznayim LaTorah also has a comment that it's really kind of a pella that we don't find that the Torah is giving us a date for Matan Torah. And in general, that's something that's noteworthy, that we know that the date of Shavuos is not identified in the Torah. In fact, before the months were set, it's not even at a set time. So the whole notion that here we're into commemorating things, that's a big part of our practice, and yet Matan Torah is so significant, and we're not told exactly when it is. So he suggests, here's Na'im LaTorah, that tentatively maybe the notion is to convey to us that as much as it's true that the Torah is given at a specific moment, and yet it's also above time and separate from time. And perhaps that's why the Torah doesn't tie it down to a specific time. And this language of, speaking of specific time, of the Yom HaZeh, on that day itself, so Shem Shinafal Hirsch has a comment that this is to show us that they encamped immediately. And it's not like other times when they scoped out the territory first. And this is to highlight that they were indeed committed to God's instructions. And even if at earlier times there were sfeikos, they weren't so committed in how they responded. So that was because they didn't have total faith in Moshe and Aaron. Now, that's not so wonderful in of itself, but it's still distinct from the idea of them not trusting God. So we want to understand that, yes, they did trust God, even if they weren't always totally receptive to Moshe and Aaron. And that's what's being emphasized. There's a comment that the Meshech Chachma has, and other Mefarshim note along these lines, that the way this Aliyah starts, at B'chodesh HaShlishi, one would have thought that there would have been a Vav here. That's the normal expectation with this kind of a context. And he suggests that the reason it starts as if it's Bereishis Bara Elokim, as if the Torah is starting from here, is because in a sense it is the case that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote down the whole Torah from Bereishis Bara until here, before Matan Torah. And only after Matan Torah that he writes down from here. So in a sense this is a kind of a new beginning. This is similar in a way to Bereishis Bara Elokim. So to have that as starting without a Vav is perhaps understandable. So then the next pasuk is very well known. Together with Rashi, it is part of a song, and it makes it memorable. And there's really a lot to comment about on these few words. So we see the pasuk says, "Vayisum rifidim, v'yavo midbar Sinai, v'yachinu b'midbar, v'yichan sham Yisrael neged ahar." So it's that last phrase that's really known for a song, from a song. But before we get to that, it's connected to the beginning of the pasuk also. So here it first tells us that the Jews traveled from Rephidim. And here Rashi quotes the idea in order to tell us that Ma Biyasan Lamidbar Sinai Bechuva Afnas Yasan Rephidim Bechuva. That they sinned in Rephidim, that's the idea that the Mechilta has, and they left from there and they did Tshuva, and they approached Sinai in the sense of Tshuva, and the Mechilta says, you see from here, the power of Tshuva. So here, this is a continuation from last week's Parsha. So especially those of you who are with us for Shabbos, this past Shabbos, it's the continuation of what I mentioned at Shal Shudas. So just to reiterate that Chazal tell us that the Jews were attacked by Amalek at the end of last week's Parsha, in the Parsha's Bishalach, because they were vulnerable, rafu yadayim min haTorah, that they were weak in their commitment to the Torah. So Rephidim is understood by Chazal as a way of conveying that message, that their commitment to the Torah was weak, and that made them vulnerable, and Amalek was able to come into attack. So we discussed in Shal Shudas the need for a constant synergy, if you will, between two different definitions of the word hand. That here, Rafu Yadayim HaTorah refers to the hand in the sense of work. This is a little bit of a Shvach synergy, perhaps, or a stretched synergy to this week's shiurim. We were talking about yod in the context of gittin, so the word hand could mean a few things. It could mean the physical hand, it could mean the domain. And here also, so we find that yad means a couple of things as well. So I mentioned the Shal Shudas in English. So yad, if you say give me a hand, it could mean give me assistance to do something, or it could also mean to give me a round of applause, some source of inspiration. And in Parshas B'Shalach, you find this dual meaning, because Rafu Yadayhem min haTorah, that their commitment to work, to learning in a serious fashion, was derelict, that they became lax in that, and that's what made them vulnerable. So what changed the course? So how was it that they were able to prevail? So that's the other kind of hand. Because Moshe lifted up his hand, and the Torah tells us that when Moshe's hand was up, so that's when they were successful, that's when they prevailed, and when it wasn't, that's when they were less so. So the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah has a comment about that. It was an expression in English, another English usage. We say sometimes if you want to know what's the crucial factor that's going to make something successful or not, we say, is it going to make or break things? So that expression appears in the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, where it asks about this. It says, V'chiyadav shel Moshe osos mulchama oshovros mulchama, that is the hand of Moshe so crucial? Why did that make a difference? So does that make or break the war? And the Mishnah explains that, no, it's not really his hand, but it's the inspiration that comes. And when he points to Shemayim, so then the Jews were thinking about God and realizing where everything comes from. And that made them prevail. And when they weren't as inspired, so that's when things were harder for them. So there's a notion that we need this inspiration, but inspiration can only take you so far. And Parshas B'Shalach, really, you see the ultimate inspiration, maybe second ultimate, they're about now to receive the Torah. That's pretty inspiring, but Kriyas Yamsuf was massively inspiring, and that's when the Jews were moved to say, as we discussed last week, they were moved to say Zakei Liv Yandeyu, what incredible inspiration. And yet, pretty soon after, they're Rafi Yadei Min HaTorah. So what's going on there? So perhaps this highlights the fact that we need a constant synergy here, that yes, you need to be inspired, because without inspiration, so then it's hard to keep going. But unless you translate inspiration into action, so then the inspiration fizzles and it expires. So that's essentially what apparently happened. Even the great inspiration of Kriyas Yamsuf wasn't able to keep them going, still roughly a day in Torah. They needed to be re-inspired by Moshe pointing to Shemayim. So that was successful. So now here they are, they're coming off of that. So perhaps that's what we mean. We say Zekayach of Tshuva, and Rav Schwab has a comment along these lines over here, that yes, in Refidim they were contentious, but once Moshe was able to turn them around, so you see that's the Kayach of Tshuva, that a little bit of inspiration is able to inspire and is able to elevate and to transform. And now here at Sinai, so they're in a different state. So we talk about tshuva. So what do we mean by tshuva? How do you see that reflected? So that's the second often quoted part of the pasuk, where the pasuk continues. It says, "Vayichan sham Yisrael neged ahar." So it is noted, as Rashi points out, that this is a singular language. So Vayichan, why is it said singular? Because, as Rashi tells us, "Keisha echad, b'lev echad." That's also a part of the song. But the rest of it that Rashi has is not necessarily part of the song. That Rashi seems to tell us that this was not necessarily typical. As much as we're proud of Keisha echad, b'lev echad, and we should be, but Rashi says here, Shar kol achalios v'sarumus v'machlokes, that other times when they encamped, they were divided, they were contentious. But now they were as one. So that's itself a powerful idea. Maybe that's a reflection of tshuva. And indeed, we know that when it comes in Kippur time, so Chazal tell us, Yom Kippur is not going to be mechaber unless we ask for mechila. And there are various explanations as to why that is, but some point to the fact that in order for there to be a kapara, we need a united Klal Yisrael. That itself is an act of tshuva. And that's what's represented here. The Azayim LaTorah notes that, in essence, even though Rashi is saying this was somewhat anomalous, but it reflects the fact that other nations are tied together by nationality, by their culture, by whatever it is that joins them, and that starts them together. The Jews, despite everything they share, so that doesn't necessarily work to bind them, and they end up very contentious and fighting, but their common goal of receiving the Torah and of living by the Torah, so that's what's able to bring them together. The Tzlach, the author of the Noda Behuda, in his introduction, so he notes that there are six pillars of the world. If you take the two Mishnayos in the beginning of Pirkei Avos, that each have three, so then put them together, there are six, because Shalom is the most important, because without that, you don't have anything. So for Kriyas HaTorah, they had to have that, they had to come together as one. The Sefer Leib Avraham, his Torah from Avraham Weinfeld, so he raises the question that's really apparent from this Rashi, that if indeed it's true that they were not normally so unified and that they were often fighting, so then how come here also they weren't fighting? So he suggests that this comes together with the whole Sinai experience. That we know Chazal tell us that Sinai was not the highest mountain, not at all. It was a smaller mountain, but it comes to represent the midah of shiflus, of anivus, of modesty and humility. So the Jews, when they realized this is where the Torah is being given, and that this is the message, so then they recognized how much they have to acknowledge the other, and how they have to have a submissive and conciliatory attitude towards the other. And that imagery, you see the power, see how much that's able to accomplish. And the Sefer Bar Yosef, so he compares this also to a statement in the Yerushalmi Nedarim, where it talks about the prohibition of losikon velosito. The Torah tells us we're not allowed to take revenge or bear grudge against others for things that we feel that they've done to us. And Yerushalmi has a comparison there. He says, let's say by accident you would hit one part of your body with another part, your arm would hit your head, or something like that. So would you say, okay, I got to take revenge against my arm, it hurt me, so I have to do something to punish my arm? You wouldn't do that. You'd recognize it's going to cause you more pain. So if you have the mentality, you recognize all of Klal Yisrael is all one entity and we're all together, we all create a crucial whole. So there wouldn't be any motivation, there wouldn't be any interest in taking revenge on anyone else. And Rabbi Yosef also suggests that this is also an answer to the question, because we know that nevuah is quite a big deal. It's not something that just comes automatically. It's something that requires a lot of preparation. So all of the Jews, on the different levels that they were on, so what enabled them to receive this nevuah with this particular type of preparation? So he suggests that this coming together as one and creating one unit is itself the greatest preparation, and that's why they were able to receive the nevuah. I think he could also perhaps speculate that the idea that this was a crucial tenai for Kabbalah HaTorah, that the Torah be given specifically when Klal Yisrael is in a unified state where there's no divisions. So maybe there's a parallel there, that we know the Chazal also talk about the fact that humanity was created in this way, that God was creating people as individuals. Adam was Bar Yechidi, Nivra Yechidi. And Chazal comment that one reason for that is to prevent racial pride, where the type of lording over one group may have over another, to say, oh, my group was created first, so instead we have one common ancestor and everybody comes from that, and there's no reason for any group, any nationality, to feel a superiority to anyone else. So perhaps so too within Klal Yisrael. We know, unfortunately, that nowadays it's hard to say that we're without divisions. But if when the Torah was given, so it was given to all the Klal Yisrael as a whole, so it emphasizes there's no room for any group to say, well, my group is better than yours, we're the group that received the Torah. Even if there are many who may now believe that, yes, they are the group that essentially has the Torah exclusively, but at least there's somewhat of a watering down of this claim, or a softening of this claim. We looked at the Torah was given to Klal Yisrael as a whole, and maybe that's also a part of the imagery. It's also worth noting that we just read the Peshalach, so that here we're so proud of the singular language of V'yichan Sham Yisrael Keneged Ahar, Ki'ishachad B'leiv Echad, but there was actually a Rashi in Peshalach also, that when the Pasuk seems to indicate that there's a singular language about Mitzrayim, about the Egyptians, as an Egyptian who were chasing after the Jewish people. So there Rashi has a very similar language. So it seems like that's true about them also. So why are we so proud about being Kishachad Balevachad if the same thing is said about the Mitzrayim? So Rav Putner has a comment in the Pachay Yitzchak, Cook also had a comment along these lines, that the language and the order is very significant. It's the same words, but they're in a different order. So regarding the Jews, it says Kishachad Balevachad. And regarding the Mitzrayim, it says Balevachad Kishachad. So what's the difference in the order? So when it comes to the Jews, we're saying that they came together, Kishachad, and therefore they created one desire, one Levachad, and therefore they received the Torah in that context. When it comes to the Mitzrayim, it was Balevachad. At first they had this common goal. They all wanted to chase after the Jews. So because of that, so to get that common goal, so then they acted Balevachad, they acted Kishachad. Essentially, that's an alliance. It doesn't represent any genuine Achdus. Instead, you have a group of people that all have a common enemy in this case, they all have a common goal, so they get together in order to pursue that. But that's not necessarily a representation of any kind of genuine unity. It doesn't show that they're actually together. It's just a function of that desire, it's just an alliance. And that indeed is not so impressive. So now the next pasuk tells us, Ramosha Allah El Elokim, so here again, many familiar phrases in this pasuk, many very resonant and impactful phrases. And just to come from the beginning, so first here the Torah is telling us that Moshe is ascending onto the mountain. So this is a very significant step. And Chazal tell us in a few places, perhaps most prominently the Gemara Masechet Shabbos, the Daf Peches, and the Midrashim, that the Malachim were not so happy about this. The idea that Moshe is coming up to receive the Torah, so the Malachim protested, and they said that you're going to give the Torah to Abbas of Adam, you're going to give the Holy Torah to these flawed human beings. How could that be? And Kadosh Baruch Hu responds that, what do you expect? So here are the humans, they're the ones who can actually relate to the Torah. The Torah has all kinds of mitzvot that are relevant only to human beings. You don't eat, you don't sleep, you don't have all the mitzvot that regulate these activities. So don't be so surprised that we're giving it to humans rather than to the angels. So this is an interesting subject, and the Rosh Yeshiva of Kehan Biavne, Rav Goldwicht, commented about this, that first of all, it seems like this response is pretty obvious. You can see that the Torah is filled with mitzvos that don't apply to malachim. But also, one way or another, what really is the problem here? So what would be so terrible if the Torah is given to people also? So the Torah comes from the Shemayim and it's given to humanity, but it still has that origin from heaven. So the fact that it's given to the people, how is that going to change what it is? Why should the Malachim be so jealous? Why should it be so territorial? Just because the Torah is also being given to human beings. So he explained that it's not simply that they're receiving the benefits of the Torah. It's that we know that in terms of interpretation of the Torah, so we are in a partnership with the Ribono Shel Olam, and we have the ability to impact it in a very powerful way, and perhaps most dramatically, the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which tells the story about the Machlokas of Lazar and Yeshua, and about various proofs that were marshaled from natural phenomena that try to advocate for the position of one side. And the Gemara tells us that Loi b'shamayim hi, that the Torah is given over to human beings to interpret and to decide what the halacha is. And therefore, the influence that these flawed human beings have on the Torah is huge. They're going to determine the path of halacha. And that is appropriate given the relationship of humans to the Torah, but that's what the Malachim were amazed at, and that's what the explanation was needed to provide to them. And related to that, so there's another very interesting comment in the Medrash, that here the Malachim apparently were trying to take down Moshe, trying to punch him out, he shouldn't receive the Torah, and all of a sudden a miracle happened, and he appeared like Avraham Avinu. And God says to them, so aren't you embarrassed to attack Avraham Avinu? Here's the one who provided the hospitality to you angels. He was the host. So don't you feel embarrassed to try to take him on? That's also a difficult medrash to understand, because what's the big deal? The Malachim didn't actually need to eat anyway. So they're going to feel so overwhelmingly grateful to the hospitality that they got from Moshe's ancestor Avraham, as if that was so significant. What's the Medrash trying to tell us there? And the Rashiv explained there, and others have similar comments. Moshe David Steinwurzel, Baba Rashiv has a similar comment as well, that the Torah, as we've already seen with a previous comment, the Torah lives through human beings, through the application to human beings, but most powerfully through the expression of Chesed. And that's why Avraham Avinu got the whole ball rolling, that he was the one who conveyed chesed and who transmitted kindness to human beings, and the Torah was spread through him. So that is what is being brought to mind here also. Not necessarily that the Malachim should feel so indebted because they got a good meal, but they were exposed to the chesed of Avraham Avinu. And that is why his descendants get the Torah, because they are human beings, but not just human beings, but those who recognize that this chesed is a crucial tool, a crucial vehicle for the Ribono Shel Olam to be perceived in this world, and that's essentially the whole message of the Torah. So that's already a powerful start to this pasuk. And say for Lev Avram, he also suggests that the pasuk is going to say now what Moshe should say to the Jewish people. So it starts off this way, Moshe comes up to God and God calls out to him. So what's the message there? It's trying to tell us that that's essentially the nature of the relationship, that we express our closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and our desire to connect, and we reach out, so then he reaches out back to us. So that is how Moshe is interacting here, and God is essentially saying, now transmit that to the Jewish people, tell them that that's how they have to interact, and that's what's going to create this connection and to solidify this bond. So he says specifically, Kosomar Beis Yaakov, Besagil of Bnei Yisrael. So Beis Yaakov may be a familiar phrase that none of you here are alumni of Beis Yaakov, but maybe you will marry some. So Beis Yaakov is familiar as the movement of women's education and many schools by that name. So why is it that these schools are called Beis Yaakov, and why is it that the whole movement was called Beis Yaakov? So it's because of Rashi. That Rashi over here tells us that the idea of Beis Yaakov, so that is apparently representing another category from the Bnei Yisrael. So Rashi here quotes the view, it's not the only view, but Rashi here quotes the view, Elu Hanashin. that this is referring to the women. And again, there actually are a number of interpretations of what's the difference between Beis Yaakov and Bnei Yisrael, but this is well known from Rashi, that Beis Yaakov refers to the women. So that, he also goes on to explain, that correlates to the verbs here, called Somar leBeis Yaakov, Visagi leBnei Yisrael. So regarding Beis Yaakov, it is Amira, and regarding everyone else, it is Haggadah. So that, perhaps, as Rashi suggests, is because Amira is considered to be a softer language, Amira Raka. And we mentioned before by Simon Sefer Imre Baruch, so if you read the introduction, so he calls it Imre Baruch because of this idea that Amira represents a softer language, that Dibre Chachamim, Benachas Nishmaim, that it's appropriate to speak in a softer way in order to get through and not to speak in a harsh fashion. So therefore that notion of Amira, so that's the suggestion here also, that that was the way he's communicating with the women. So why should it be that the women here are mentioned first then? So if that's the case, that this is the distinction, so why should it be the Nashim are instructed first? So many have a comment, Rabbeinu Bachya, and more recently Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Darish Moshe, and others, that this represents the fact that if you want the Torah to have a kiyum, if you want it to last, so you have to first go to the household, and you have to first speak to the mothers. The mothers are the ones who set the tone for the household, and long before there's any formal education, they are the ones who are going to have the influence on children and make sure that they imbibe the spirituality. So the first address is to speak to the women. And perhaps that's also the idea when it comes to minhagim. So Chazal tell us that we're supposed to observe minhagim. It's Divrei Kabbalah. It's a pasuk that comes from Nach. That we say, Shema b'ni musar avicha, v'al titosh taris imecha, that we should not abandon the Torah of the mothers. So that's considered to be a source for the observance of minhagim, even though some point out it's a little bit surprising, because if there's a difference between the father's minhag and the mother's minhag, so we normally assume that we follow the father's minhag. So how come minhagim are identified as taras imecha? So presumably the point is that yes, if there's a difference, maybe we'll follow the father's minhag, but overall the notion of the minhag is being conveyed as taras imecha, because it is the Torah of the household. It is the intuitive wisdom of how halacha and mesorah should be observed through what the mother is able to convey through the Torah Simecha. So here we understand, it makes sense, that they are addressed first as the conduits of the tradition. My grandfather, in the Sefer Meshivas Nefesh, the Torah Tamina, so he added another suggestion why it should be specifically that Beis Yaakov should be a reference to the women that we haven't really seen an explanation for. And he suggests that it goes back to the Pasuk and Parshas Toldos of the Rivko Heves is Yaakov. That the Torah tells us that when it came to Yaakov and Esav, so it was Rivka, the mother, who was able to figure out that Yaakov was going to be the bearer of the tradition, and that through that, he was the one who indeed took on that mantle. So Rivka's appreciation of this is a part of the same theme, that the mother is able to recognize how the chinuch of the children should go and where the children are inclined. And that was the midah of Rivka, and that was perhaps focusing on her appreciation of Yaakov. My grandmother Taka was named Rivka. That's perhaps a part of the point. Okay, there's also another fascinating point here that was made by a wonderful Talmid Chacham. I think we mentioned him recently in a different context. He passed away last year. Rabbi Shmayahu Shulman in his Sefer Meirish Bibira. So he notes that here, this highlighting of this division, is how we understand it, between the men and the women, specifically at the time of the giving of the Torah, so that has another theme to it, that when it comes to Bnei Noach, as far as we know, we don't have major distinctions between men and women as far as role, as far as obligation, and that's something that becomes a thing with the giving of the Torah. And his suggestion is, it's because now we have the message that we need everyone, that specifically this achdus, the fact that we all form one whole, so now it's possible to say that there should be a division of roles, and that while they're all equally important, but they have this distinction, and that's enabled by the fact that you have this unity of Klal Yisrael, that we're all one entity, and that's evocative of themes in macroeconomics, that when you have a unified world, and everybody is providing for everyone else, and then you can have a division of labor. If everyone was an island, if everybody acted on their own, so then they'd have to be very inefficient, and they would have to produce for themselves everything they need. But because we have a cooperative world and a global economy, so then you can have specialization and you can have different roles, and that's going to maximize what the world can accomplish, at least theoretically. So through here, it seems like maybe that's what he's getting at, that once you have this idea that Klal Yisrael is a whole and that they have their individual roles, so then it's possible now to take on different parts, and therefore this distinction all of a sudden becomes relevant. There are a number of other distinctions that you find in the Mefarshim. So this idea that it's specifically the Nashim and the men, it's not the only way to see it. Some understand it in different ways. Some understand it as Beis Yaakov is a distinct group within B'nai Yisrael and separate. Some see the Beis Yaakov as the simpler people. It's again a separate track of interpretation. That's not on the interpretation that we need to learn. Not necessarily, but it's interesting because there it doesn't mean simple in the same sense. But there are different ways of understanding what's going on here about the different groupings of Klal Yisrael. This is the most well known, but there are other interpretations as well. So the next pasuk, so it tells us Atam Yisem Asher Asis LeMitzrayim VeAsaschem Al Kanfei Nisharim. So now you have seen what I have done for you, what I did to the Egyptians, and how I carried you on Kanfei Nisharim. We normally translate Kanfei Nisharim as wings of eagles, which certainly, especially for Americans, I guess, has a more dramatic and noble image. It's not 100% clear that that's really what a Nesher is. Some understand Nesher differently, as a Griffon vulture, a different kind of bird, maybe doesn't have the same kind of noble imagery that we associate it with, but the whole idea of God lifting us up on his wings is interesting imagery, and Rav Hirsch suggests that Nesher is related to Nezer, which means to keep away, and also Netzer, which means to protect. So the bird flies up high out of the reach of man. So this spoke a little bit of synergy for those learning Daf Yomi. So Daf Yomi is learning the Sefer Nazir. So the Shoresh of the word Nazir is itself a discussion. And the idea that Nazir perhaps represents, in a positive sense, the concept of precious, of separation. So the notion of that kind of offense is perhaps also what is conveyed here, that maybe there's an etymological relationship between Nesher and Nazir. The Oznayim Torah suggests that this whole imagery is about a sudden uplift in faith and spiritual madrega. And in the Sefer Mishnah Sacher, which is the Torah of Rabbi Sacher Teichtal, who would go on to write the Ema Banim Smecha, that the classic of contemporary Zionism. So he notes that it's interesting to focus specifically on this idea of being lifted on Kanfei Nisharim. Why is this miracle specifically being highlighted here? So he points to Rashi and Parshas Bo, that this was connected to a very quick trip from Ramses to Sukkos. And why was that necessary? So the Al-Sheikh explains that was because of the dough that they had prepared for the matzah. If they didn't go quickly, so then that would have become chametz. So, okay, so why is that the miracle to highlight? The Mishnah Sacher suggests that it's to show that if those are people are really devoted to doing mitzvahs, even if it's challenging, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help. So that miracle represents this idea of God helping out the influence of the people who are looking to do mitzvahs and who have shown that desire and that initiative. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take you to that next step. And that's itself very significant. Now the next pasuk tells us, "V'ata im shemoa tishmu b'koli u'shmartem es b'si v'isi li segula mikol ha'amim." So here, if you will listen, you will obey, and tishmu b'koli. So I think we've commented in the past. You find this language in the Torah a few times that it's very significant that to obey, one would normally translate as l'shmoa l'kol, to listen to the voice. Shamea Bikol means listening kind of to the voice itself, not just obeying, but paying attention to the sound. And some have pointed out that the meaning is that it's not just the letters, not just the content in the words, but it's the message that's behind the words. It's what's between the lines. And that whole idea that we are sensitive not only to following God's direct instruction, but also the broader picture of the intent of the Torah, the Ratzon HaTorah, within that, and that we're looking to try to interpret what the message is. And that's the idea that we find reflected with mitzvahs such as Kedoshim Tiyu and V'asis HaYashar V'HaTov, that we should not only pay attention to the details, as important as that is, but also to understand the Ratzon HaTorah, but also to see what's behind it. So that's a very powerful notion. We have the idea that that's how the Avos essentially rose to their stature, that they figured out the Ratzon Hashem without having a direct tzivui, and that kind of sensitivity is what we emulate. And that also the notion that Chazal instituted all kinds of dinim d'rabbanan. So one understanding of that is that they were appreciative of what the intent of the Torah is, reading between the lines, and not just listening to the voice in the sense of obeying, but bikol, listening to the voice itself, and understanding what the intent is and what the ratzon is, and therefore creating dinim that protect that and enable that. And that's the whole basis, according to Avochanu Wasserman and others, of the notion of dinim d'rabbanan. So we become a nation to God, v'yisam li sigulah mikol ha'amim, ki li kol haaretz, that you become a distinct nation to God because the whole land is mine. And as Nayim Torah comments here, that even though the Ovdei Avodah Zarah, so they believe that every nation has its own God, but we recognize that that's not actually the case. And God says that all of the land is mine and all of the people are mine. And still within that, the Jews have a special status as his distinct nation, as a segula. There are those who comment that we know that on Pesach night, so we sing Dayenu, and we talk about Har Sinai, but we say that not only are we grateful for the receiving of the Torah, but Ilu Kervanu Lifnei Har Sinai V'lo Nasamanu Es HaTorah Dayenu. So if he had just brought us over here and not actually given us the Torah, so that would have been enough for us. So that prompts the question, really, would that have been enough for us? How could it be possible to say that we could have been okay without receiving the Torah that defines our whole essence, our whole identity? How could that be? So presumably it doesn't actually mean that. That's probably the straightforward answer, is that Dayenu doesn't really mean that our lives would have been complete if we had stopped at any specific point. But we're talking about our obligation of Hodah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we're saying that even if we'd only reached a certain point, so or even on each point by itself, each one is significant, and therefore we have to be grateful, so to speak. If a person, let's say, went through a very dangerous trip and he was threatened by all kinds of things along the way, and he finally makes it to his destination alive, so he's very grateful that he was able to overcome all of those obstacles, and he's thankful to God for each one. So it doesn't mean that he would have been just as happy if he hadn't been saved from all of them, because he wants to get to his destination alive. So if any one of the 10 threats had killed him, so he wouldn't have made it. So it's hard to say that it would have been enough for him just to be saved from 9 out of the 10, or 5 out of the 10. But when he says Dayenu, really it means that he has to be grateful for each Hatzalah, for each time that he was recovered. So presumably that's what Dayenu means also on Pesach night. We're saying not that we would have been okay had we never received the Torah, but that we have to be moda to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for every step along the way. But nonetheless, the connotation there that there's perhaps something that could have been focused on by itself, of just Kirvanu with Lifnei Har Sinai, just being brought there without receiving the Torah. So what exactly is that meant to convey? So believer Balaam Shechon Bracha suggested that it has to do with the Achdus that we mentioned before, the fact that Ke'isha Echad V'Lev Echad, and we recognize that as something that is independently valuable, and therefore we're grateful for that as a thing in of itself. The Brisker Rav, not mistaken, understood that it was about Yiras Hashem. And here, our Sinai, with all of the display that's going to take place, is very awe-inspiring and reverence-inducing. So the notion of the Yiras Shamayim that is transmitted through the Sinaitic experience, so that itself would have been worthy would have been something to take note of even without the next step of actually receiving the Torah. But also a part of it is this whole idea of Yisem Lila'am, that we are now our Yisrael Segula Mikol'am, and that we are brought together as a nation that is distinct to God, and that's also something that we are focusing on and we are grateful for in of itself. And that's what the last pasuk, certainly very resonant phrases in this next pasuk, that comes to also highlight for us. So what does it mean? We're going to be a school of Atem, Tiuli, Mamlechas, Kehanim, the Goy Kadosh. So this is what you should tell the Jewish people. This is what they should understand before they receive the Torah, that you're going to be a Mamlechas Kohanim, that you're going to be a kingdom, a nation of Kohanim, and a holy nation. So the idea, the imagery of being a kingdom, and the idea of being Malachim, so the Rabag notes here that it's a way of signifying that, yes, we're about to receive the Torah with all of its rules, but that shouldn't be seen as a burden. That shouldn't be seen as something that's very difficult. Adarab, but this is something that confers royalty and, in a sense, a life of luxury, not in the sense of taking it easy, but in a sense of great richness and great depth, and something we would associate with kings. So before we receive the Torah, you should understand that's what it means. This is your royal legacy that is about to be given to you. And you are a Goy Kadosh. You are a nation that is separate. And the Slonim HaRebbe and the Nesiv HaShalom, so he comments on the fact that the whole definition of a Jew is to be Kadosh, is to be separate. And that's a part of their identity, not necessarily as a mitzvah of itself, but as part of what it means to be Jewish. You know, the Ramban, in the beginning of Parshas Kedoshim, so he highlights Kedusha as a mitzvah in and of itself, but here in a different sense, we're saying the whole nation is holy and distinct, and that itself is a part of what's happening here, is that you're receiving the Torah, which is giving you a distinct national identity and separating you from the rest of the world, in order to be able to transmit this mission. The Lev Avraham comments here as well, that there are perhaps two types of tzaddikim, that there are those who are very much out there influencing the world, and maybe that's what we mean by a Mamlechas Kohanim. When we talk about Kohanim, so clearly it's not a whole nation of Kohanim, and we have all types among the Jewish people, but the notion is that the same role that the Kohanim play for the Jewish people, so the Jewish people then play for the rest of the world. So just like you have Kohanim, who are there to lead a distinct life and to teach everyone else what it means to be devoted to God and to service to community, so too, that's the role that the Jewish people play regarding the whole rest of the world, to be like Kohanim in that context. So that's something that some will be better at than others, this notion of being able to be out there and to be a model and to be an instruction. So there are some that are more of that type. And there are others who are more about precious, who are more about being very distinct, the Goy Kadosh. And he suggests that neither type is necessarily preferable to the other, but to understand that we have both within our levels of tzaddikim. We have Kohanim and we have Kedoshim, we have those who are very involved in teaching and those who are very separate, and these may constitute two separate groups. But that's also something that is a part of the fabric of Klal Yisrael and how it comes together and accomplishes its mission. And there are those in general among the Mefarshim here who see the structure of this pasuk as continuing the theme that we had before about Beis Yaakov and Bnei Yisrael. So the whole idea of a dual structure there, not necessarily about the women and the men, but about there being perhaps different levels, about there being those who are more focused and more involved in Tzidkus and in the nation as a whole, that there's also two tracks being referred to here, a slightly different kind of understanding. But the idea being that everyone is a part of a Goy Kadosh, that the whole Jewish people is here to be a distinct nation and to contribute that to the world. And within that, there are Kohanim. So it doesn't necessarily mean that everyone is a Kohen. It doesn't necessarily mean either the kind of Kohen status that we're talking about within the Jewish people. But in a similar sense, there are many Kohanim. There are many who are able to go out and display the message of the Ribbono Shel Olam and to carry that banner. And it's important to note that if that's the nature of the interpretation, so we don't mean that it's a Kohanim in the sense of being designated in advance and you either are or you aren't, but presumably this is a more meritocratic kind of system, but this is something which is subject to one's initiative and one's dedication, and it's evocative of what the Rambam writes in Mishneh Torah regarding Shevet Levi as a whole. And the Rambam writes that even though Shevet Levi is a distinct family group within the Jewish people that has a special role designated for them, but the Rambam emphasizes that still anyone else can take up this role as well, that Kol Bayolam, actually, that sounds like all of the world population, anyone who decides that he's not going to be so caught up with the Cheshbonos HaRabim by the various calculations and other distractions that tend to weigh us down, and he's going to live a very dedicated life to Klal Yisrael and to spreading God's message. So that's what it means to be Shevet Levi. That's what it means to be this type of a Kohen. And that this is a mission that is open to all of us. And that's part of the very powerful message of this Aliyah. So this Aliyah, again, is not the one that's going to get the most attention, but there's such crucial themes here telling us that there has to be a recognition of the crucial unity of Klal Yisrael, and that even if that hasn't always been our specialty, that we have to be able to activate that and connect to that in order to be a nation that is worthy of receiving the Torah, but also even has the possibility of receiving the Torah, which could not have been communicated to a divided, fractured Klal Yisrael, and that that's perhaps something that miraculously took place, and maybe it's through the influence of the modesty of Har Sinai, but somehow the Jews were able to create that unity at that time and to provide the context for the Torah to be transmitted to them as a whole. And once that's the case, so we recognize that we're never going to be the same again. Now we have a mission now of being a Malachas Kainim Gibay Kadosh, of being a nation. The expression Or Lagoyim is from the Navi Yeshaya, but here we have the Chumash itself giving us a similar idea, this idea that we're here to be a light and to be a source of inspiration and modeling to the world. And it's something, of course, which is so easy to forget. It's something where too often we find that there are situations of Chil Hashem and of embarrassment in different ways for the Jewish people, and the lack of continued awareness that we're always going to be the center of attention, and that that is the purpose, that we are here to be able to be a light and to be a Malachas Kohanim B'Goy Kodosh, and that the Torah is given to us in that context, that this is the theme, this is the message to us before that receiving of the Torah. And the more we are able to connect to that and to internalize that, then the more worthy we are, both as individuals and as a nation, to indeed receive the Torah. So I wish you all a very inspiring Shabbos of the Seder Sadibros. It should indeed have that effect, that it should elevate us and should charge us for a recommitment to that holy mission. And I look forward to seeing you on Sunday as we continue the learning at that high supercharged level.